Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Macramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. Baseball is great for the minor storylines and bizarre occurrences that emerge continuously throughout the season. Last week, Gabe Kapler made headlines, but this week the focus shifted to the Twins. Last Sunday, the Twins were beating the Orioles 7-0 in the ninth inning. Minnesota starting pitcher Jose Barrios had a one-hitter going when Chance Cisco of the O's stepped to the plate and proceeded to bunt against the shift for a base hit. The Twins were none too pleased with this, sounding off after the game about Cisco breaking an unwritten rule by bunting for a base hit in that situation. Barrios, Brian Dozier, and Eddie Rosario were among players who weighed in on the subject. Dozier, in particular, had a weird take on why Cisco and the Orioles were in the wrong at one point, saying, "When the Orioles didn't hold our runner on, they conceded the fact that they didn't want us to steal, so we didn't steal." So what are our thoughts on this? Do the Twins have a point at all, or are they just being kind of ridiculous?
I mean, the latter. It's fully the latter. People, it seems like every season we have another unwritten rule, quote-unquote, that somebody breaks, and it's just always leads to the stupidest arguments ever in favor of these, quote-unquote, unwritten rules.
Yeah, I have seen many people note that if the Twins were so concerned about unwritten rules, why were they shifting in the ninth inning of a 7-0 game? That also seems like it should be a violation of unwritten rules. It seems completely unnecessary. And it's like, if you're going to do that, then how can you blame a guy for trying to get on any way that he can? You know, it's the whole point of baseball is to get yourself on base, and you don't stop trying that just because the other pitcher is pitching well. It wasn't even a no hitter. Like, you know, I would have understood where they were coming from a little bit more if that were the case, but it was a one hitter. Like, no one got on after that. I don't think it was a two hit shutout. That's like a fantastic game. Anyone should be happy with that. And, you know, it just seems like a really unnecessary thing to be causing a stir over.
Yeah, I love that the very first time that Dozier spoke about this, it was outrage over breaking up a one-hitter as if that were, you know, actually a thing.
Yeah, like, the first thing I thought of was, like, it's not a no-hitter. They're already giving up a hit. What's the point if another player gets on base? It's not like they're breaking up a no-hitter or a perfect game or whatever, and it's like, you're already up 7-0 in the ninth. Why are you so concerned about someone bunting against the shift for a hit when everyone basically been experimenting with extreme shifts? Like, it just seems like smart baseball to try and bunt it so you could beat the shift. I don't know. Like, as much as I hate bunting, like, it's a good strategy against the shift, and baseball's weird.
Yeah. And I think this ties into so much of, like, purity of the game nonsense that needs to kind of be reexamined and be taken out of the game. So hopefully, you know, things don't kind of progress throughout the season with this kind of stuff between the Twins and the Orioles, because that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, there's been a lot of dumb rivalries in the history of this game, but if you, like, explain to someone, you know, a few years from now who's maybe come into the game and didn't know why the Twins and Orioles had this big beef, and you explain to them that this was why, like, 99 out of 100 people would think that was preposterous.
Yeah, and I feel like if they're, you know, trying to protect the purity of the game, you know, someone should show them how they played baseball in the late 1800s and how a walk was more than four balls and just all the weird rules in particular, and just Yeah, someone should show them, like, if they want to go to how baseball was originally played, that's going to be a lot weirder game than it already is right now. Twins, stop being that petty. That's just extreme pettiness to a level that doesn't need to be. So, last season, MLB streamed 20 games on Facebook, though the games were also carried on TV. However, they're taking things a step further this year by streaming 25 games exclusively on Facebook, beginning with Wednesday's Mets-Phillies matchup. Did any of us watch the Facebook broadcast, and if so, what did we think?
I did not watch it, but I saw screenshots of it, especially screenshots of the Facebook comments that were rolling in. And you know, I think Facebook commenters really rose to the occasion. There was a lot of Russia discourse, which was fantastic to see, just because of the contrast between the comments and the baseball game itself. So I think I enjoy seeing that aspect, but I'm not sure I would have enjoyed actually watching the game on Facebook.
Is that something you have the option to turn off? There, it's got to be, right?
Yeah, I think so. I think I saw somebody put instructions on how to turn it off.
Okay, at least that is there, because, you know, it's not that I don't want to hear what other people have to say when watching a game, but, like, that's what I use Twitter for the most part, and I very carefully curate my list of people whose opinions I am interested in getting. And I still, like, just the thought of seeing randos on Facebook, you know, weighing in on, not even on the game necessarily, just on, like, random things. I feel like that would be so distracting. I also did not actually watch the broadcast, so I can't comment on, you know, its quality or anything like that. But I am sure I will have to at some point. You know, I know there's a Dodger game on there at some point, and it's possible that I'll have to be covering a Facebook streaming game for work. But, yeah, I am curious to check it out just because it's something new. It's something different. I think, you know, there's a lot of initial resistance to things that are new and different, but at the same time, I think that a lot of the criticisms that I read are probably valid, though I'm maybe not in the best place to judge without having actually watched, so maybe all this commentary is just completely useless, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, I also did not watch. I was driving from Arizona to California while it was happening, but I don't know. I feel like the way that it's set up feels like a Twitch stream. It just felt very online to me, and the comments were also just kind of like, you know, just added another layer of that online-ness, and it just felt like how the comments are when you're watching a very ridiculous stream, like the town center in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and everyone's trying to count how many red trucks pass by. And I feel like there's going to be a weird community that comes out of, you know, Facebook exclusive games and weird memes that only pertain to this community, which I get, but it's also like appealing to a specific kind of audience, which isn't necessarily bad. I'm just worried about how accessible it is for other people, especially for those who don't want to watch it on Facebook.
Yeah, I think that's one of the issues with having it exclusively broadcast on Facebook. You're going to get a certain demographic watching the game, and it's going to be likely people that would have watched the game on, you know, anyway on TV. So I don't know that you're going to pull in any sort of new audience, because younger people have either deleted their Facebook, because they just found it so useless, or they never had one at all. So you're not going to be marketing the game to them at all. So I don't know how this in any way will grow the game, whereas with last year, it just added another option for people to watch the games, and I think that that's kind of a better way to do things.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea of free streaming games that, in theory, anybody can watch, you know, without necessarily having cable or an MLB TV subscription. You know, they streamed some games on Twitter, too, last year, if I'm recalling correctly. That's not a thing that I'm making up, right?
No, you're correct.
No, they had it.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, that was a thing that happened. I remember watching some games. I think in that case, they were blacked out if you were in the local market. So, you know, it didn't necessarily help in the case of, like, people in L.A. who might not have Spectrum and can't watch Dodger games. But nonetheless, it definitely offers greater access to people than, you know, having it be something where you have to have the specific cable provider, or you have to be in the region, or you have to have MLB TV, which is, you know, not hugely pricey, that's the word. It's not hugely pricey. But, you know, it's nonetheless, it's, you know, $100 whatever that not everybody has to spare. Anyway, what I'm getting at here is that, I like this idea in general, but I also don't like not being able to get it on TV at all. Obviously, there are ways to, like, hook up your computer to your TV, or you can Chromecast, but it just adds extra step that seems like kind of an unnecessary nuisance. And that's a relatively minor complaint. But yeah, I think basically what we are all kind of getting at here is that there's seeds of a good idea in streaming games online for free, but the execution maybe leaves something to be desired and is obviously kind of more serving Facebook here than it is baseball fans.
Agreed.
Yeah, the next question I was going to ask is, you know, if, you know, what we thought of the idea of games being broadcast solely on social media platforms, and particularly Facebook. And, you know, I completely agree. It's a great idea, especially, you know, trying to reach people who might not have been able to watch certain games before, especially those who are in a different market and don't get those games on TV, or they can't afford MLB TV, or MLB TV is just very... I know they ditched Flash this past offseason, so it's not exactly working the way that everyone wants it to work at the moment. But, you know, social media streaming is a great idea in theory, but then in practice, it's just, who knows?
I'm just wondering how many older people had to call somebody else to get them to... instruct them on how to actually access the game on Facebook, because that at least seems like something that I would think would have been the case for a lot of people.
There's got to be at least 10 people being like, hey, I don't know how to work this. Where's the game? Tell me where the game is on.
I'd put my money on that number being a lot higher. Although I will say my grandparents, like, you know, for all of their struggles with technology, Facebook is something that they seem to have figured out pretty well. I don't know if that is a trend across all octogenarians, but it's something I've observed with my own grandparents. So I don't know, maybe the older demographic was able to figure it out. Maybe we're being too uncharitable here.
That's true. I mean, they definitely know the ins and outs of Facebook, at least with normal Facebook use. That seems to be Facebook's demographic. And so they definitely understand Facebook, which is kind of surprising, but also, you know, not in the sense that younger people have kind of moved away from Facebook.
Yeah, I feel like, if anything, it's not really you know, questions of how to use Facebook, but, like, people being confused, like, why isn't the game on TV? Why isn't the game on MLB TV? Where am I going to find the game? Is this game blacked out? Is it not being broadcast? It's more, like, logistical things. And then, you know, those who are like, oh, the game's on Facebook, I'm just going to watch it there. You know, there's some people who don't want to deal with Facebook considering everything that's been in the news about data collection on Facebook. So, you know, while MLB may be gaining new fans, they're also going to probably lose some for partnering with Facebook in this way just because of all the data stuff. You know, I know a lot of people have started to delete their Facebook accounts because they don't want any more data being shared, and it's just very, it seems very self-serving rather than a way to reach out to more fans.
And I don't know how I feel about the number of divisional games that are exclusively broadcast on Facebook. I think it's fine for games that are not between divisional opponents, but it would be nice for, you know, the more intense of the games to be able to be watched on a number of platforms.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, there should be more variety than just divisional games. Like, throw in some interleague games there for a while. You know, throw in a Phillies-Padres game or something. I don't know, just more variety than just, like, the must-watch divisional matchups, especially this early into the season where it might not even have any kind of effect on the outcome of the division.
Apparently, roughly 77,000 people watched the game. Of course, I don't know how that compares to normally broadcasted games, but it feels kind of low to me, and I wonder how many people would otherwise watch it on MLB TV at work, maybe, if that's not blocked, whereas Facebook, I think, is something that a lot of workplaces block.
Yeah,
and that was another thing that I heard people complaining about, like, you know, they might be able to have MLB TV streaming in the background of work because it's like, you know, listening to music while you work. And I've heard that a lot of workplaces don't really have much of a problem with that. But Facebook's another story, and so many employers block the ability to be on Facebook on the job. So it's like, what are you really trying to do here, MLB?
Yeah, and these are all afternoon games, I think, that are being streamed on Facebook. So, yeah, it's going to be – and are they all on weekdays too?
I'm assuming so.
Yeah, that would make sense because I think maybe they're thinking of trying it with games that are, you know, less likely to be highly watched and highly in demand, even, you know, despite the fact that there are, you know, some of these are divisional games. But nonetheless, this is a good point that it does block out a substantial portion of the working population. It's, you know, social media networks are often considered to be not conducive to productivity in the workplace. So they're blocked. So that seems like it's kind of unfair to people who might have been interested in having the games on otherwise.
Yeah, and I also think that a lot of people who are free at this time to watch a game are college students when they don't have classes in the afternoon on particular days. And I think that a lot of those people no longer have Facebook. But would otherwise maybe have access to television in some way.
Again, it just feels like a very self-serving thing. And, like, I get from the whole capitalistic standpoint why MLB is doing this. I don't necessarily like it.
No, I think it might be a little short-sighted.
I agree. Yuli Gurriel, who received a 5-game suspension for directing a racist gesture to Yu Darvish in Game 3 of the World Series, served his suspension at the beginning of the season while he was injured, after which he was immediately placed on the DL. Is this a legitimate way for him to have served his suspension?
Not at all.
No.
Yeah, this wound is still a bit fresh for me for a number of reasons. And, like, you know, I obviously, anybody who cares about people not being horrible to other people should be upset about this. But, like, you know, the fact that it happened when it happened and it happened to someone who was on, you know, my team in, like, the most heated, like, possible environment it could have happened in, like, it all just kind of adds to it, I guess, especially because I think the Astros went on to win that game. So there's a lot of anger I have regarding that situation. And, you know, the fact that he wasn't adequately punished at the time was enraging enough as it is, but now the fact that he's getting away with basically not even serving a punishment at all, it's infuriating. There's like there's no way to say it that is, you know, it's just really kind of maddening that someone could essentially be racist, do this racist gesture on a nationally televised broadcast and get totally away with it. Like, get, you know, some verbal criticism, I guess, but not actually have to pay for it in any way. I mean, well, technically, I guess he paid for it because, you know, he lost that money from his paycheck, but, like, how much is that actually going to affect him? Like, not that much.
Yeah. And I think that it's even more enraging due to the fact that we all suspected that maybe not this particular instance would happen, but that the suspension would be swept under the rug, which has obviously been the case. And it just demonstrates that, you know, these teams, these players, Major League Baseball need to do more work to ensure that the game is as inclusive as possible.
Yeah, I agree. If Gurriel wasn't injured already, like, they would have just put him on the DL and then, you know, tried to have him serve a suspension otherwise. But it's just like, he's already injured. You're not really losing him for any kind of, you know, actual punishment. And it's just very frustrating. I know that with, you know, there was a big discussion over whether it was really racist or not, and I'm just like, does this really have to be a conversation? And I know that it was more eye-opening, especially in the conversations of people of color being racist towards another ethnic and racial group, and I think that was a conversation that was necessary to have. I just think that with the way this suspension worked out, in which it happened while he was injured, it just didn't seem like a fair punishment. He wasn't going to play those games regardless. What does it really do for him and for the team? And also for the fans who don't like seeing this, fans who are uncomfortable, you know, with the fact that this is something that was able to slide, and the fact that, you know, they waited until April to have him serve his suspension and not have him, you know, immediately suspended the rest of the World Series. I know there were a lot of arguments saying, like, oh, but it's not fair to punish the rest of the team because, you know, it's just Gurriel who did this. But, you know, I'd heard a lot of people say, like, so just replace him on the roster. That's a different thing. You know, you can replace him. There's nothing against rules, against, you know, replacing a suspended player, so you're not down to 25 men on the roster. It's just, there are a lot of arguments that were beside the point about Gurriel being suspended in the first place, and I just feel like there's so many other solutions so that, you know, it's not necessarily punishing the Astros per se, but punishing Gurriel. And the way the suspension worked out, just, I knew it wasn't going to work out in the way that everyone wanted it to, but I think it's just more infuriating because he was not going to be able to play those games regardless. I have many, many feelings about this and the World Series in particular, because I remember if it wasn't Game 3, it was the next game that was incredibly long and going back and forth, and I'm not even an Astros or Dodgers fan. I'm a Giants fan. So I'm just like, the fact that I'm upset that the Astros won because of Gurriel and all this weird back and forth change in leads, I'm weirdly upset about it.
Yeah, that was game five. And let's not talk too much about it.
Yes, please do not.
Yeah.
I'm begging you.
It was just not a fun World Series. I will leave it at that because it would have been so much easier if they just handed him punishment right away. Maybe the rest of the World Series would have been fun, but we had this looming over the entire series, and I feel like it's just not fair to so many players and fans. This week, Adrian Beltre tied, then broke Rod Carew's records for hits by a Latin American-born ballplayer. Carew's career total was 3,053, with Beltre's two hits on Thursday and multiple hits after that. He now stands alone among Latin players at 3,058, which puts him on 23rd, put him at 23rd on the list overall. What is the significance of Beltre hitting this mark?
I think it's very significant. I think it's fantastic. He was already the first Dominican-born player to reach the 3,000 hit total, so this is another fantastic milestone for him. I think we all agree that he is an incredible presence in baseball, and it must just be so great for the Dominican Republic as a whole to see him having this much success over such a late career.
Yeah, it's a testament to how long he's been playing and how good he's been for a really long time. In every full season that he's had in the majors, he has recorded at least 100 hits, many seasons going far beyond that. He's just been basically nothing but excellent for a really long time. And to see him, you know, continue to hit these milestones and to move his way up on the all-time hits leader list, it's been fun. And, you know, it seems like he's just a guy who really kind of deserves all the success in the world. So it's nice to have someone who you can really feel good rooting for and who we see keep sort of hitting these achievements.
Yeah, like every time I hear about Beltre or watch Beltre play, it's just pure joy, especially how like everyone tries to rub his head. You know, he's a positive force in the game, and you know, it's something that is great to see. You know, he's the kind of player we need more of in baseball. I think it's extremely significant that a player of Beltre's caliber has had this longevity in his career, and the fact that, you know, not only are his talents not waning right now, but he's also, you know, becoming more beloved in the game. The fact that he was, you know, he broke this record by, you know, being the, for, you know, number one on the list of Latin American-born ballplayers with the most hits in MLB, and, you know, climbing up to 23rd on the hits leader list overall is incredible. Speaking of, you know, on the leader list, where do we think Beltre will be, you know, by the time he hangs up his spikes?
That's a good question. This is the final year of his contract with the Rangers, so he's going to be a free agent after this. You have to think that he may be able to find maybe another 1 or 2 year deal after this, which maybe puts him at another couple hundred hits or so, in which case that would have him finishing up around 3,200. That's a conservative estimate, I think. But that would have him at around 13 or 14 on the all-time hits list. That would, you know, that's, again, that's assuming that he, you know, continues to play at the level he has been this year, and, you know, is able to get another contract, like I said, but I imagine that he will. He is 39 years old. It's actually just today. He's 39 years old. It's his birthday. Happy birthday, Adrian Beltre. So he's not a young guy, obviously. You know, you don't, obviously, if you've been playing for 21 years, then you are not going to be on the young side. But nonetheless, he's probably still going to be able to perform at a pretty decent level for the next few years. And I think estimating 3,200 career hits for him seems reasonable.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that the Rangers are essentially interested in bringing him back for however long he would like to continue playing baseball. So I don't think that him finding a place to play will be any obstacle for him. So I agree with that. I think that he probably ends up, around 12, 13. I don't know. He might take over Eddie Collins, who has 3,314, but I think that's kind of a real stretch at that point.
Yeah, I think he's going to reach somewhere, you know, in the high teens, you know, somewhere between like 13 and maybe 20 for sure. I think he's just going to be great to watch the rest of the season, and I think we're just going to see him keep hitting. Where he'll end up exactly, I'm not entirely sure, but I don't think he's going to stay 23rd on the list forever.
Yeah, next up on the list for him is Craig Biggio. He's only two hits away from him. And actually number 21 is someone who is also still active, and that's Ichiro. So be fun to see who ends up with more career hits between the two, though I think it would be pretty safe to guess that it's Beltre, just because he's probably going to be getting a lot more in the way of playing time than Ichiro. But, yeah.
And he also has 5 years on Ichiro, roughly.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Although, like, betting against Ichiro, like, people who do that are fools at this point.
Very true.
Yeah, I just feel like it's going to be, like, it's not really, like, a rivalry type of race, but more just like a celebration of two great players like Ichiro and Beltre, you know, still managing to climb up on this list. So, the good part of baseball. Now we have Twitter questions. This one is from Robert at Rowest. Will Joe Panik hit the home run title, and isn't Shohei awesome? No. Joe Panik will not. This is the Giants we're talking about, and they play at AT&T Park, and even if Joe Panik keeps hitting on the road, he's not going to keep hitting home runs at AT&T Park. And yes, Shohei Ohtani is awesome.
Yeah, he does not play enough games against the Dodgers to be able to win the home run title. And right now, he and Ohtani are tied with three home runs. So Shohei is pretty awesome, and I would imagine that he will even pass Panik at the end of the season for a number of home runs hit.
Yeah, there was... Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think Shohei Ohtani will surpass Panik with home runs hit by the end of this month.
It was kind of fun for... I think it was maybe into the fifth game that the Giants played, where every single run that they'd scored was provided by a Joe Panik solo home run. It almost made that whole nonsense of him homering off of Kershaw and Jansen in the first two games of the season worth it, just for that stat. Except it wasn't, because that was terrible and it made me want to die. Not actually, but like, you know, in the over dramatic baseball sense. You know, the logical side of me says that he won't win the home run title, but the very non-logical side of me says he hit home runs off of Clayton Kershaw and Kenley Jansen. He's unstoppable. He's going to win the home run title. So I'm going against you guys and saying, yes, Joe Panik is going to win the home run title. And as for Shohei, yes, Shohei is awesome. I think anyone who disagrees with that is boring, and I have no interest in talking to them because they bore me so much.
I guess that answers that question, and I agree. Next question is from Alex at ALRCT75. Are there any common in-game events you would get rid of, i.e. the kiss cam?
I have two.
Yes.
I'm not sure that you would qualify each one as an event, but I will say God Bless America. Get that out of the game. It's a terrible, terrible song, and it's very, very redundant when we already play the anthem every game. And then my second one is just anything involving mascots.
I would also eliminate God Bless America. I would eliminate the kiss cam. I think I would eliminate the Simba cam.
The what?
At Chase Field. So at Chase Field, they have this thing called the Simba cam, which is literally you lift up your child, like in The Lion King. You know, where Simba's being lifted up over that cliff and like everyone gathers. And yeah, it's just, you know, they play the Circle of Life and you lift up a child that you have with you at the ballpark. And yeah. That's a Simba cam. I just feel like it's very weird to lift up your child as the Circle of Life is playing at a sporting event.
But it's that people... fine tradition of using your child to get attention for yourself.
It's true.
Very true. I am amused at the people who chose to lift up their beers or their food during the Simba cam. But it's also like... I would get rid of it in the same way that I would get rid of the Sacramento Kings baby race. Yeah, anything with babies, probably. I would
get rid of babies.
Yes. No babies at baseball games. That's an in-game event that we can all do without. Yeah, I'm totally on board with getting rid of the kiss cam. I hate it so much. It is at best incredibly awkward and at worst super heteronormative and oftentimes homophobic. It's been a thing where teams have shown like two players on an opposing team on the kiss cam and it's like, oh, it's funny, it's two guys, haha. And it's like, oh, come on, it's 2018 or whatever year it is. It's like, stop that. So yeah, it is my least favorite thing that they do, and I've been ready to see it go for years. It was never a thing that needed to exist in the first place. I don't need to see other people's affection broadcast on a giant screen. No one wants that.
Oh, I have another one. Marriage proposals.
Yes.
Yes.
They just like...
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't, like, even if it's okay with the person who's being asked the question, like, it's just awkward, and it's just awful, and it should be eliminated. I think that in a lot of cases, I mean, public proposals just in general, and especially when you have the attention of, like, 30,000-plus people on you, I think that it's easy to be pressured to say yes, which is horrific, and it's just so terrible on basically every level.
Yeah, I'm just reminded of how in my nearest metropolitan region in Fresno, during the Super Bowl, they had the super proposal in which, like, I think a local jeweler sponsors someone to propose during the Super Bowl. And it's a very public proposal, and you have to wait to, like, after the Super Bowl to find out if she said yes, and it's also very heteronormative. And I'm just like, why do you want to do these weird displays of things like this in public? And it's just like, it's not memorable to anyone else. It's only memorable to you. Like, why are you letting us in on that? It's just, I don't get it.
So essentially, keep your personal lives personal, everyone. Don't bring them to the ballpark.
Yes. So... our next question is, are there any giveaways you're particularly interested in this year, This is also from Alex at ALRCT75.
The Red Sox are doing one in September, and it's like kind of a bobblehead kind of thing, with Pedro Martinez being duct taped to a pole, which happened to him, I think in 1999. He was duct taped to a pole by a bunch of teammates, I think primarily Nomar Garciaparra. And I think that that's just a hilarious new spin on the bobblehead.
That's fun. I like when teams get creative with bobbleheads and, you know, do things that are more than just, you know, a guy standing there on the mound or whatever. It's fun when, you know, they manage to capture an event or they manage to capture, like, a characteristic of the player. This is... Well, actually, I don't know if we've actually seen the design for this or not yet. But what I'm excited for this year is the Dodgers are doing a Rich Hill bobblehead, which it's about time. Rich Hill deserves a bobblehead as much as anyone in this game. Mm-hmm. I've already got my tickets for it, so I'm getting that.
Very extra.
I will see what I can do about that. I feel like people will be holding on to them very tightly because why would you not? But I'll try to finagle you guys something. There was one, this is not one that's coming out this year, but apparently, I think it was last year, I found out that the Toledo Mudhens did a Corporal Klinger bobblehead giveaway. You know, the character from MASH who was a big fan of the Toledo Mudhens, and having just watched the show, discovering this was really exciting, and now I'm really sad that wasn't a thing I knew about at the time, because even though I would not have been anywhere near Toledo and couldn't have gone to a game or anything, I wish I'd been aware of it at the time so I could have known that it was a thing that was happening. Of course, it wouldn't have meant anything to me then because I hadn't watched MASH yet, but I don't know. What I'm getting at is they should have waited a year to do this so that it would have worked out for me, so that I could have been aware of it and appreciated it. And I really don't appreciate when the universe conspires against me like this.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's terrible that they did not personally make you aware of this. It's a huge failing on your part.
Thank you, Mary. Welcome. I appreciate your support.
Anytime.
I would have to say that one thing that I'm very interested in is that the Giants are capitalizing on Buster Posey giving enormous hugs at the end of, like, really big games, and they're calling it Buster Hugs, and they're having a Buster Hug bobblehead this year. Last year they had the Buster Hugs blanket, and I think they had Buster Hugs mug the year before that. It's just very... I just feel like it's very pure and, like... not at all, like, a typical bobblehead. So I'm very excited to actually see what that will look like. And I think that, you know, I think it's also interesting that that game is going to be against the Rangers in August, and Tim Lincecum might be in town. So I just feel very... I feel a lot of emotions because I just keep thinking about how Buster Posey, like, lifted up and hugged Tim Lincecum after his two no-hitters. And I also think that the A's are doing a lot of great promotions. They are giving away a Black Panther bobblehead.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's great, yeah.
Yeah, that one is very cool, especially because there's, you know, there's Oakland ties to that. So I think it's just really great that they're doing that. So our last question is from Mitchell. Why is defensive indifference a thing? It just seems almost spiteful.
Yeah, it's something I might take a bit more seriously if it was something that was ever called in an inning besides the ninth inning. Because, yeah, there's plenty of times where a runner goes and, like, there's not really an effort made to get them out. But you only ever see it called that in, you know, the ninth inning of a game when it seems pretty clear that it, you know, the team that's pitching is going to win. And it just, yeah, it seems like a kind of arbitrary call to make, I guess. I don't see the harm in just giving a player a stolen base instead. It's definitely one of the more useless stats in baseball. Or I don't even, do you even call it a stat? Just a, like, a ruling, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it kind of fits with the aura of baseball. It's just kind of like another weird little quirk that people are like, who are new to the game, are like, wait, what's happening? So I like that element of it. But now I'm also really interested to see it called in like the second inning of like, you know, a 13-0 game or something.
Yeah, I think it just doesn't make sense why it's not considered a stolen base and why it always is like later innings. And I'm like, just call it a stolen base. You know, there's no harm in that. Yeah, it just seems incredibly spiteful. And I think I forgot to give Mitchell's handle at the beginning of the question, which is MG McConaughey. I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that right, but now I'm just thinking of Matthew McConaughey. Sorry about that, Mitchell.
I'm sure he's never gotten that before.
McConaughey? I don't know.
Just stop.
After an uninspiring spring training, Shohei Ohtani has quickly impressed in his first full week of MLB games. Ohtani made his MLB pitching debut last Sunday, pitching 6 solid innings. He allowed 3 runs on a home run in the second inning, but put up zeros in every other frame. He struck out 6 batters and walked 1 while even touching triple digits with his fastball. In addition, Ohtani has gotten off to a great start with the bat, going 7-for-18 with 3 home runs in his first 19 plate appearances. Joining us to discuss Shohei Ohtani's first full week of Major League Baseball is Manila-based illustrator, formerly with Kauai Baseball, and a general fan of NPB and MLB, Aya Francisco. How are you doing today, Aya?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thank you for coming on.
Yeah, I'm so excited.
Yeah, we are very excited to have you as well.
Cool.
So I guess to give our listeners a bit of background information, how did you become a baseball fan and how long have you been following Ohtani's career?
Oh my gosh. So I started watching MLB games around like 2009. So basically it was like an on and off thing, because I never really had a team I wanted to follow, and I only watched it because I was only watching games that was like whatever was on TV back then, because, you know, in the Philippines, there's not really that much baseball stuff. So you take what you get, you know. So yeah, at the same time, like, I was like a big fan of Yu Darvish as well, because when he was still like a pitcher for the Fighters. Because I saw him on a show on NHK. It's like a Japanese TV channel, and they were talking about his career, and I was like, wow, this guy is kind of cool. So, like, maybe I should root for him. Yeah, and, like, kind of, like, it only really clicked for me, like, baseball, like, when I saw a Giants game, and Tim Lincecum was pitching. And I was like, whoa, like, I really, like, wanted to know what a changeup means, so I had to Google that down and stuff. And I really liked it. And that's when I started, like, being more active on Tumblr and on Twitter, and I made friends who were Giants fans, and, like, I've been following the Giants ever since.
I think we have somebody who can relate to that on this podcast.
Very much so.
I think that's one of the things, like, Jen and I bonded on at first. I'm like, yeah, have you seen Tim Lincecum? It was like, amazing!
Yeah, I think, like, our earliest messages to each other were, like, messaging each other back and forth, like, 2011, I think? Talking about how great Tim Lincecum is. So, what would you say are your early impressions of Ohtani's MLB performance?
Oh, well, I saw his first start against the A's, and, like, when I saw it, I was like, nothing much has changed. It was basically like watching a Fighters game, but Mike Trout's on the team and is giving Ohtani high fives now. That was weird. But it's really amazing, and like, I never imagined it happening. Like, he's adapted so quickly to a new environment and stuff, like in all aspects, like in terms of playing styles and coaching. And it's really been great so far and exciting to like see him play in America.
There's been a lot of talk and speculation about how he would translate from MVP to MLB. What did you expect for him in his transition?
So, like, I was, like, at first I was, like, scared he would overexert himself and he would, like, end up injured or, like he wouldn't acclimatize to his new environment and stuff. So, yeah.
Has anything about his first few games surprised you at all?
Oh, well, I didn't expect him to hit, like, back-to-back-to-back home runs. That was, like, surprising for me. Like, that felt like something from a sports anime scene. I didn't expect him to do that at all.
Did he do anything kind of similar in his career in the MPB?
Well, yeah, I guess. I think I saw him, like, when he was, like, pitching and then hitting, like, in between games and stuff, like, he would, like, I would remember him doing the same things, like, back in 2016 when they won the Japan Series. Like, yeah.
Are there any similar players in MPB to Shohei Ohtani this season, or do you think he's a truly generational talent?
Oh, yeah, of course. Like, I've seen MPB position players who've been, like, aces in Koshien, that's Japanese high school baseball, and like, but it's rare to see like someone play both positions so well and maintain that skill set to a professional level. So like, for me, of course, like, no doubt.
That's really interesting, and I think that we don't see so much of that in America with baseball. It's you know, more focused on the individual elements of pitching and hitting. So I think that's kind of one thing that's really exciting for people in America to watch him.
Yeah, it is. I'm excited to see him, how he'll like perform in the U.S. So,
do you have any predictions for the rest of his season or for the rest of his first few years of his contract?
No, I just hope he'll like be healthy, not get injured a lot. Because I've seen some people say that, like, oh, he's going to get injured, like, he's doing both at the same time. And, like, I hope he just does well for his first season and, like, hit more home runs, I guess.
Yeah, I think we'd all like to see that.
Yeah, like, what if his, like, streak never stops and just keeps hitting home runs whenever he's at bat?
Yeah, there was something that I saw earlier that Babe Ruth also hit home runs in 3 consecutive games when he was transitioning from pitcher to hitter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the only other player to have done that is Ohtani. Especially, like, even in the age of the designated hitter, like, even though the National League still has, you know, pitchers who hit, no one's been able to do the same thing as Ohtani or Babe Ruth. So it's just incredible to see Ohtani bring such life to baseball.
I know. It's, like, super exciting, like, seeing him right now, like, being amazing. Like, I'm trying to contain, like, screaming a lot. And whenever I see him, like, play and do stuff, like, oh, my gosh, he's doing so well in America. Because, like, he's talked about it a lot, like, before he got drafted by the Fighters, he was like, oh, I want to go to Major League and, like, maybe not go to MPB because maybe it's much better, like, I'll do well. And, like, so, yeah, it, like, the Fighters happened. He got drafted and stuff, and he kept mentioning in interviews, like, when I turned 24, like, I wanted to achieve all this, and, like, I want to go to the U.S. and, like, have success there. And, like, it's really amazing, like, to see him do all this stuff, like, succeed and, like, whatever he mentioned of, like, getting, like, what, like, when he won the Rookie of the Year award, he said he wanted to win that, and he did it. And, like, I was like, that's amazing. Like, he's doing his stuff, like, in his own way and in his own pace. So it's amazing to see him, like, do so much amazing things, like, and he's so young. And I don't know. It's just amazing following him for, like, 5 years now.
Yeah, that must really be kind of seeing, like, you know, a good friend or a child go off and do these great things.
Pretty much. Like, you've seen him, like, grow, like, see him go to the U.S. and, like, do everything he said he wanted to do. And I think it's amazing.
All right, too. Kind of round out the interview a little. You do some really incredible illustrations of baseball players, and you've kind of done that as part of your career at a certain point. Does the creative side impact how you view the game at all?
It did. Like, when I started Kauai Baseball a couple of years ago, it was, like, mostly a way for me to decompress after work, and I didn't realize, like, it would get a lot of, like, attention from people, and, like, it made me appreciate the fans and every team, like, seeing their perspective, like, getting to talk to them and, like, reading their stuff, like, why they were fans of their team, and, like, why a certain player made them happy. It made me, like, happy as well. Like, back in 2015, like, I made a series of illustrations about notable figures in the Negro Leagues, and it gave me a lot of insight on how baseball was in America for integration. So, yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Aya, for taking the time out and joining us today. And I know the time differences are a little
brutal.
I know.
It's nighttime, right? I'm sorry.
It's about 7:30 in California right now.
Yeah.
9:20, well, close to 9:30, where
it's pretty.
Mary is. So, thank you, Aya, for joining us today. You can follow Aya on Twitter at Aya Pizza. Thank you once again for coming onto the podcast.
Thank you for having me. Yeah.
And now, this week's article summaries. Sarah?
Thank you, Jen. On Monday, we had From Sportsmen to Investment Bankers, The Evolution of Baseball's Owners by Jack Moore. Jack tracks the ways in which the baseball ownership class has changed over the years, from its early origins of mostly men who had some connection to the game, to ownership groups often tied to the financial services industry. According to the author, there are two main differences between early and modern owners. One, early owners did not make nearly as much money off their teams as modern owners do. And two, early owners almost always had ties to the cities in which their team played, which is not so much the case anymore. Jack's piece doesn't necessarily argue for one archetype being better than the other, but rather serves as a sobering reminder of the forces that exist behind and control the game that we love in the wake of an ever inevitable labor war. Then on Tuesday, we have A Rivalry Renewed with a Tantalizing Twist by Christopher Dale. The Yankees-Red Sox rivalry is as exciting as it's been in years. It's also the first time that the two teams have been on seemingly equal footing in the two wildcard era. In this article, Christopher explores the history of the rivalry leading up to this point and what this new twist means for its future. Then on Wednesday, we have the Pyramid Rating System's 2017 Season Update by Paul Moringer. Paul's back with this pyramid rating system, this time taking into account how 2017 impacted certain team standings with the rise of certain players. For instance, Cy Young Award victories for Max Scherzer and Corey Kluber boosted their profiles in their franchise's ranks. This is, of course, an ongoing project that will have changes made to it for as long as Paul keeps it going, and it's fascinating to track how a team's legacy can evolve as the years go on.
And then on Thursday, we have Misery Loves Company, Baseball's Worst Losses, AL Edition, by Shane Tortolotti. Shane is back with the AL-centric accompaniment to his first article on worst NL teams' losses in baseball history. To recap, by worst loss, Shane means the loss that evoked the most heartache for a particular fan base. Well, it should be no surprise that the Yankees feature heavily here in doling out the worst losses. There should still be some surprises on the list that may ease your pain and put things into perspective for you. Because misery loves company. If you're going to read this piece, get a friend to read it to. Then, rounding out the week, we have The Physics of the Home Run Boom by David Kagan. As the title suggests, David is back with another fascinating article breaking down the physics accompanying and behind one of the biggest trends in Major League Baseball, the home run boom. Breaking down the physics of batting itself, David divides the process into two categories, the things accompanying the swing itself, such as swing velocity and the location of the ball on the bat, that the batter can change, and the qualities of the bat, such as height and weight, that the batter cannot change. To see how each group pertains to the home run boom, read David's piece.
And next week, we have John LaRue returning with his Ground Rule Doppelganger series, presenting the closest matches for the NL. Asa Beal and Michael Wentworth offer their scheme on how to make some of baseball's least watchable teams watchable. Shohei Ohtani is drawing comparisons to Babe Ruth. Mike Duncan looks at some of the forgotten Negro Leagues players who might also serve as comps for the two-way star. Stacy Gatsoulias returns with another random box score. And finally, Steve Goldman examines a dying breed of first basemen. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find all the articles mentioned in this episode at fangraphs.com/THT, and you can find the site on Twitter @Hardball_Times. I can be found on Twitter @JenMacRamos. You can find Sarah @SarahWexler32. You can find Mary @MaryMCraig. You can find the podcast on Twitter @THTAudio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times Audio on fangraphs.com/THT/THT-audio and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.